Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody. Coast to coast, This Week in America. Grit and Grace, The Transformation of a Ship and a Soul by Deborah Rudell, is one woman's account of conquering overwhelming challenges with tenacity and ingenuity, and ultimately discovering her inner strength. Deborah's world unravels when the leaders of her spiritual commune are exposed, arrested, and imprisoned for bioterrorism and attempted murder. Crushed and adrift, she moves her family off the commune to create a sense of normalcy. But when her husband seeks an opportunity to dismantle and rebuild a derelict 50-foot schooner, Deborah uproots the children once again, joins him in Hawaii. For the next 5 years, she dedicates her life to restoring a boat. While there, she grapples with her emotional turmoil and contemplates a new life path. Deborah sets out to accomplish something she never thought possible, sailing across the Pacific to the Olympic Peninsula. A college professor in San Diego, Deborah participates in her city's vibrant writing community, a graduate of Hay House Writers Workshop, and the Certificate of Memoir Writing Program at San Diego Writers, Inc. Her work has been published in the International Memoir Writers Association's anthology, Shaking the Tree. I didn't see that one coming. Deborah lives with her black cat in a tiny house built, by the way, in 1906 by a retired sea captain who carved a sailing ship into the front door. This is her first book, Deborah Rudell, author of Grit and Grace, The Transformation of a Ship and a Soul, our guest on This Week in America. Deborah, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rick. That was a lovely introduction.
Well, I wanted to set sort of the stage for everything that you've done. And about 4 or 5 hours, we could cover everything that you've done and been through. It's such a remarkable life. Sharing it now in the book, Grit and Grace, receiving excellent reviews. Let's start with the decision to write the book. Why did you decide to write Grit and Grace, which is highly personal?
Yeah, I had thought originally it would be articles for Wooden Boat magazine, you know, technical articles.
Yes.
About sanding and painting and fixing. And so I didn't really think about the story behind it until I was in a writing group and I was writing my technical stuff and they would look at me glazed over and say, "But what were you thinking? Where were you? What were you feeling about all this?" So eventually they pulled the story out of me. And then I started writing this book.
What was it like writing the book and going back and recounting all of these experiences that you and your family went through, the ups and the downs? You mentioned the good, the bad, and the ugly. It is all there. What was it like going back and reliving to write the book?
It was a very interesting journey and one that I had not expected. I thought I pretty much knew what my life was about. But when you go in and you actually start writing and exploring the little nooks and crannies, you realize that your life has been pretty rich and there's been a lot of things there. And rewriting this book has helped me have a much, much bigger appreciation for the adventures and experiences I've been privileged to have. And also to see the depth of understanding, wisdom, growth that I was able to experience having this life and these adventures.
You know, it's interesting you mention that. As I'm reading through this, this is written with perspective of what, several decades at least, so you've got time to grow and mature and to think back and to sort this out. Is this a book that you could have written 20 years ago, or did it take real life experiences and the perspective of maturity to be able to write this?
No, it absolutely needed to be written now. When you're in the middle of being in a community with a living master, you're just doing all the stuff every day and just busy, busy, busy. And it wasn't until we went to Kauai and I was actually sanding and varnishing, and that repetitive motions and repetitive tasks that helped me sort of go inside. It gave my mind time to start exploring what went on there. What were you doing? What did you discover? What was that about? Very, very rich and rewarding time. And one that I had no, you know, you don't know that's going to happen to you when you're sanding and varnishing, but that's what happened to me. I started looking back and putting things in perspective, integrating my life experiences.
You know, it's interesting you talk about years of what you call mindless labor working on the boat. You could sense changes in yourself. Talk about that, because that really was an extended period of introspection, wasn't it?
It was. It was, you know, 3 or 4 years, hours and hours. You know, a 65-foot mast might take you 5 days just to sand it.
Wow.
And then you've got to put 4 or 5 coats of varnish on there, and you got to wait a day. And, you know, it takes, and caulking, you know, it takes, there's 40 seams on a boat, 20 seams on each side, and I could only do 2 a day. That's how long it took to go down 40 feet. You know,
yes,
with the caulking iron. So you do have a lot of space. You know, the physical part is one thing. It's like the Karate Kid, wax on, wax off.
Yes, yes.
It's a meditation that just automatically happens. Yeah.
Deborah's
and I'm glad I had that time.
Well, it was you and your mind and a chance to go through that and the memories and sort all of that out. Deborah's book is Grit and Grace, The Transformation of a Ship and a Soul. The book is available wherever books are sold. Deborah's website is Deborah Rudell, RUDELL.com. Links on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Books, of course, available at Amazon and all of the usual places. Let's talk about the spiritual life, the community that you were in. How did you get there? What was the impetus to take the family and to join the commune?
Yes, good question. I actually had a little bit unusual childhood. I had a grandmother that influenced me very early on that I was more than just this body and this life that you could see, that there was actually a spirit inside and a soul journey. And she exposed me to books like, and people like Edgar Cayce and reincarnation and those sort of karma, those kind of things were ideas that weren't normally talked about. She was a yoga teacher in the 60s, so that was a little bit unusual. So from an early age, I knew that I wanted to keep doing everything I could to grow inside, to learn who I was really, not just this physical body, to be in touch with that energetic, my soul and my heart. And so everything I did in my life was to make that space bigger, to have more of an opportunity to explore that. So by the time I was 20, I had heard about spiritual teachers and I'd explored different things like rebirthing with Leonard Orr, different yoga retreats with different yoga teachers. And then I ended up hearing about Rajneesh. And I personally didn't really want to go and be with Rajneesh. My husband did. I thought he was too radical for me. But as you read my book, you realize that I had an experience where I realized Rajneesh was my teacher. And so as you have that desire inside, then you make choices in your life that are going to put you in situations to grow in that way. And I think that's sort of why my life kind of went the way it did. And when it was time to go to the ranch, it was the ultimate opportunity. I could live with a whole bunch of people, like at the peak of Rajneesh Puram, there were 10,000 people there.
Amazing.
And it was like a real city. We had an airport. We had a public transportation system. We had all of the infrastructure of roads, electricity. We had a power station that created the electricity for the whole place. So it was quite a remarkable opportunity to go and live with like-minded people that we're looking at a sustainable lifestyle and also aware, everyone being aware of an inner life that we wanted to nurture and support in ourselves and each other.
You know, it's interesting as I'm reading this, a little bit about the childhood. You grew up 60s, 70s, a neighborhood with a lot of children. You talked about the independence and the autonomy. When we think of communities, when we think of communes, we think of giving up independence and autonomy. Is that something, is that a myth, or does that actually happen, and did you struggle with that?
That's an interesting question to answer, too. In a community, this community was set up like a kibbutz. So the men lived somewhere, the women lived somewhere, the kids lived somewhere. And we all had all three meals every day in the same place. So we just did our job every day. We didn't have to do things like shopping or driving or buying clothes or, you know, all of those things in our normal world that we have grown up in and we're conditioned to, those things were different. So all you did, you went to do your job, but everything else was taken care of for you. Your clothes were all washed every day, and at the end of your bed when you got home, the home was beautifully cleaned and vacuumed and fresh flowers out. Like, it was amazing. You were just cared for in every way, and your job was just to do your job. And it was, when you're doing that, in one way, people can say, oh, you don't have any autonomy. But in another way, you're freed up to explore other parts of yourself. So that's why it's an interesting question. In one way, yeah, you're not going off to the movies on Thursday night just because you feel like it.
Well, yeah, exactly.
But in the other way, you're freed up from all the things of having to deal with money, for example, and bank accounts, and is the rent going to be made? And, you know, if you need a doctor, you don't have to go look for one and figure out your insurance plan. You just go to the medical center and you're cared for. Like, so there was a lot of freedom in that.
Like so many things.
But as far as
yeah, it's not black and white, is it? There's a lot of gray area there, and I fully understand now, and I appreciate you answering that, because you think of that you give up everything when you go into the community. Let's talk about what happens when the world came crashing down, when there are arrests, there are accusations, there are charges. You talk about you gave everything to be part of a community, and it's over. What initially was that like for you, trying to understand your world at the time as you knew it had just been shattered?
It had been shattered, and I had given up everything for it, like you said. So it was very, I think the right word really is shattering. And then also that framework that I'd grown up with and lived my life for that spiritual framework, was also completely dismantled. So I became very disillusioned about spirituality, about God, about anything other than what I could see and touch and taste. The five senses, that was it. I really had been so thinking that it was the truth and then realizing that it wasn't. And that was a very painful, difficult time that I couldn't really deal with until I was sanding and varnishing. And then I had more space to start to think about it, because it was a painful place to go into.
In between that, when you left the community and before you started work on the boat, you go back to the small town, you're back to the dentistry practice, your husband is back there as well, family's back, trying to settle in. He decides he has to try something else, and that, of course, is the boat, which made no sense, I don't think, to you at the time. But what was that like, that transition, going home and the fact that he wasn't satisfied there, he wanted to do something else? What were your thoughts during that period?
That was tough for me, because I was so happy to be back in the little town and running a dental office and having my kids with me and shopping and cooking and doing all the things that I hadn't done for 5 years or so, you know, like it was really great. I liked it. But as you mentioned, my husband was not happy at all. So he found this boat and I rebelled. I was like, no, we're not doing that. That's impractical. We've just now got ourselves together and back into a life. Why are you going to mix it up again? I was pretty unhappy with that whole idea. And I struggled with it for probably almost 10 months, I think. We went back and forth. And then I realized that my life would be hell if he was unhappy. So I said, I caved. I said, great, I capitulated. Go ahead, let's go. 6 months, that's no big deal. I can handle 6 months. So we went, we did that because I wanted him to be happy so that, you know, as a family, we'd be happier.
Yes.
But then, of course, as you read, it was not a six-month project. It ended up taking 4 or 5 years, you know, to actually finish.
So you're off in Hawaii. You mentioned this before. This was sort of a time of what you called spiritual digestion. Yeah, it's you and your thinking. And what was that like? Did you have any idea this would open up this whole new avenue of sorting out everything?
No idea at all. And that's kind of the magic of when you have big life changes. So they look a certain way. Like I was kind of dragging my heels and thinking, oh my gosh, well, it'll be nice to live in Kauai. That's a tropical island. I'll enjoy my swims.
Yes.
But I had no idea of the depth of the gift that it would give back to me. And remember, I don't know if you know about Hawaii, but the islands all have different vibrations. Kauai has been traditionally, like in historically, people never lived on Kauai. That was the island you went to heal, to do your spiritual work. The kahunas went there to do their special rituals. And when I think back on it, yeah, it was the perfect island to be on, to have this other part of my world, you know, the energetic world, my emotional world, my spiritual world, start to come into more understanding, more clarity.
What was it like when you have this boat, which I understand was what once owned by Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young? This was a boat of theirs at one point?
Yeah, it was one of their party boats. And the picture of it was on the cover of their Southern Cross album.
That's amazing.
And then, of course, they sold it and it got in a hurricane and it was a wreck on the dry and we got it afterwards. So we didn't have anything to do with the famous people, but the boat had been, you know, a party boat.
But it's a great part of the story there. And by the way, do you know who happened to own this boat a couple of hurricanes before we took it over? The book is Grit and Grace, The Transformation of a Ship and a Soul by Deborah Rudell, R-U-D-E-L-L, the author and our guest on the program. Her website is deborahrudell.com. Book available at amazon.com, all the usual places. Acorn Publishing, LLC.com is the publisher. Information there as well. And, of course, a link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. You got into this project thinking, a few months, this is fine. I can probably handle this. Years later, you're working on the boat. What was the hardest part for you, the hardest part of rebuilding the boat, the most tedious part of it?
The most tedious part. I would have to say that for me, I was just kind of doing jobs that I could do. For my husband, the most tedious part was probably figuring out the rigging because it was all in pieces when we got it. For me personally, the hardest part was that my husband was completely engrossed in this project, like monomaniacal, or if there's such a word. And it was really hard to not have, you know, like time with my husband and have kind of connection time because he was just immersed in this project. And as time went by, I had several times I packed my bags, I was fed up with the thing, but I would eventually come back and I found my enjoyment of being in the project as well because it was such a rewarding thing to see something so broken down and so messed up become something so beautiful that it actually won awards later on, like big awards, like best restorative boat, best restoration, best wooden boat. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. It what was the cover of a magazine, so it the Elixir, the name of the boat, so when you got back, that had a life of its own and success on its own. What was it like when you were going through this period of working on the boat? You start off by thinking, will this ever end? I don't think this project is ever going to be successfully completed. But then you actually see an end in sight. You see that all this work is paying off, and it won't be long. We'll be able to take this out to sea. What was that like when you realized all this work is going to pay off?
That was pretty amazing too, because you have a routine of getting ready, getting the lunches made, packing everything in the car, going down to the boatyard, doing your work, you know, for 8 to 10 hours a day, doing it 5 or 6 days, 7 days a week for all those years. And then suddenly it's done. And there, in one way, there's this, oh my gosh, because you have to make another shift in yourself. And then I had to start researching sailing. I had to start taking sailing classes with the Coast Guard, how to do this and that, get my ham radio license. Then that's what you had to do. Learning to read charts, learning to use a sextant, all of these things. So my mind was completely occupied with trying to prepare myself for the next leg, which was going to be sailing this thing across an ocean. And then also outfitting a boat with enough food and first aid supplies and trying to figure out every case scenario you could think of so you had what you needed to survive. So my mind was very preoccupied and filled up with preparing myself adequately.
Once you take off on the adventure, you say the sea can be a terrifying, especially the wind, rain, and storms that romantic stories fail to mention. You're talking here, and everybody's probably thinking, boy, this would be great. You hop on the boat, you have a couple of days, and you're where you want to be, and you've had this great great little adventure going. There were harrowing times, weren't they? I mean, you'd heard at one point the two words you never want to hear in the ocean, and that's skipper overboard.
Yeah. And actually, he went overboard when I was off watch. So I was trying to sleep. And when I came back up on board, on deck, my son, he's like a little bit, he calls it like it is. Let's say it that way. He let it slip. And they'd already promised each other they weren't going to tell me because they knew I'd be really upset. But, of course, he couldn't keep it in. And he said, yeah, you should have seen him. He was just hanging there, you know. And I'm like, what? Anyways, yeah, that was a very serious thing. That was actually a very serious thing. Yeah.
And the whole journey, it's interesting you talk about the construction setbacks, impossible tasks that you had to face, and you faced and you did that successfully. Finally, going through two gales, seasickness, near knockdowns. What was it like during the trip? Were there points when you thought, we're not going to make it?
Oh, absolutely. The first 3 days, after 3 days, we were in a gale and everybody was really sick. You know, you have to get your sea legs. You've heard that expression. More like get your sea stomach. Anyway.
A whole body getting rid of. Yes.
It was pretty harrowing to be in a gale. And then when you're in a gale, you can't see the sky. And so our navigation, you don't really know where you are. It's difficult. And now, of course, everybody has GPS. It's not a big deal. But at that point, we had a Loran, so we would get a fix every 3 or 4 days, maybe, that the satellite would go over and hit our little radio receiver that would pick that up. That was very scary. And then the most scary part, though, was that my husband did not ever get over his seasickness. So we were gonna turn around. And then if you read the book, we ended up meeting a boat out there who was experienced and on the radio, so we could talk to each other. And that skipper helped us kind of decide to keep going. Because he said, oh, if you go back, you're going to go back into more of that bad weather.
Well, yes, exactly.
Like, no, we'll keep going forward.
How long did this trip take? How long was this?
It was 23 days from leaving to actual landfall, 23 days. But that was a long 23 days, I have to tell you.
I'm thinking as you're mentioning
You don't throw the anchor out and sleep overnight. You're on call that whole 23 days.
What was it like, that moment when it was a land ho moment, when it's like, look, that's where we want to go. There's land over there. What was that like when you saw land and you thought, I think we're going to make this?
That was amazing. That was probably my most amazing day, because I was the navigator, and the West Coast of North America is pretty big. So we were going to hit somewhere for sure. But the fact that we hit where I wanted to hit was amazing to me. we were right on that Olympic Peninsula at Neo Bay. That was absolutely miraculous. And the first time anybody does that, I'm sure it's the same, because when you're out there, you don't see anything. You don't see anything at all. And it was very remarkable. Yeah, that was a good day.
Yeah, I'm sure there are moments and visual images that will stay with you forever of that moment when it's like, we are going to make this. The book is Grit and Grace, The Transformation of a Ship and a Soul by Deborah Rudell, our guest, R-U-D-E-L-L. The book is available wherever books are sold. Deborah's website is Deborah Rudell. More on the story there. You'll be able to order the book there as well, DeborahRudell.com. You ask at one point in the book, and this was after the community fell apart, and this person that you were trusted, you really felt you were betrayed, and you knew that you were betrayed by what happened. Then you find yourself in a shipyard in Hawaii doing mindless work trying to get this ship restored. You ask yourself, had I wasted my life? Looking back at it now, how would you answer that?
Absolutely not. And that being betrayed by the master was actually, and I talk about this in the book too,
yes,
that it looks like a betrayal, but actually that's part of the process. If you really want a deep connection with the divine, you need a master, you need groups, you need people around you, you go along as far as you can, and then a true master will kick you out of the nest, and you have to learn to fly towards the divine on your own soul wings. And so I see that now. At the time, I had no idea. But I see that now, that he fulfills his job of making sure that I kept on the path to a real deep introspection into myself and my own connection to the divine.
That's interesting, as you look back and able to sort out those experiences. I'll quote one more time here before we leave, because I think this is so important. You talk about sometimes the act of restoration, whether of a ship, a life, or a soul, is the greatest adventure of all. Talk about that, because you went through that and really discovered so much about yourself.
Exactly. And that's you know, another reason why writing this book was important to me. I really would like everyone who reads it or who's interested in reading it to know that every part of your life is very rich, very important, precious. And there are important aspects to it and repercussions that you have no idea. And when you do find out near the end of your life, or maybe not even for a while, your eyes just pop open and you're like, wow, that was amazing. And here at the time, you didn't really see it. So I would like everyone to kind of know that no matter what it seems like in your life, how difficult it is, how boring it is, or whatever, make sure that you have that little idea in the back of your head that, you know, life is a lot more than you can see. And there is all kinds of gifts that are there hiding if you take the time, the effort, and have the intention to see deeper.
One of the many lessons you'll get from Grit and Grace, also acceptance of the past, something so many of us struggle with, and Deborah was able to face that and brings it out in the book. The book is so well written on so many emotional layers. Grit and Grace, The Transformation of a Ship and a Soul by Deborah Rudell, R-U-D-E-L-L. Our website is DeborahRudell.com. Link on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. Deborah, an excellent job with this book. First book, it's going so well. Are you thinking about a second book?
There's a few books in there, and I've got some outlines in Scrivener, but I haven't really started writing so much because I'm still just doing all the things that it takes to launch and yes. advertise and get the word out about this book. So I'm looking forward to the time when I can, you know, and it won't be long, a few more months, and I'll be able to sit down and get into another story. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to that and the opportunity to talk about that. And yes, you've done the creative part with Grit and Grace. Now it's the business, the marketing, all of this, and getting the word out to the public and getting them to share your story. And the reviews are excellent. The book is Grit and Grace. Deborah, thank you for being with us on the program.
Thank you so much, Rick, for having me. I've enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to have you here and to share your story, Grit and Grace, The Transformation of a Ship and a Soul by Deborah Rudell. Information on our website, thisweekinamerica.us. You're listening to This Week in America, and we're back on today's program right after these messages.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.